Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. I want a long road that just won't stop winding. I want that lightning that's so bright it's blinding. I want a sky full of stars to be under. I want to feel that country. Well, hey there, everyone. It's Stormy Warren welcoming you on the bus at Country Thunder with executive producer Troy Volhoffer. Coming to you from Music City, we can't wait to chat with all of our friends in country music. Get ready for real talk about the state of the music industry, thoughts and insights from some of its biggest stars, and more than a few backstage stories from the 6 annual Country Thunder events held all across North America. I know I'll be sharing some great stories in a future episode. So buckle up and get ready for your new favorite podcast. Here's Troy. Whoa, whoa,
whoa. Hey, everybody. So glad today is one of the most exciting days that I have had in a long time because I have my dear friend here, Marty Stewart, live on Country Thunder on the bus. Marty, great to see you.
Dr. Volhoffer. Good to see you, my friend.
Man.
Another Country Thunder.
Yeah.
Big shows.
It's been a while since we've seen each other. And what have you been doing through this quarantine process that we've been into for the last year? What have you been up to?
Well, the only thing different is I didn't go on the road. I think 6 shows or 8 shows, I don't know, held together from March until the first quarter of 2021. We made records as a band, finished Connie Smith, my wife's 54th album.
Wow.
What else? We're working on our cultural center in Mississippi, working on a museum exhibit in Jackson, Mississippi. A new TV show, new TV pilot. So stayed busy and got around. I haven't been home this much since I was 12 years old. And so I got a lot of things caught up that I've been meaning to do for a long time. So wow. It was a good time, actually.
So, Marty, you grew up in Philadelphia, Mississippi.
I did.
And so how did you become acquainted with the Staples? How did that come down? How did you know them?
In 1964, there was a movie called Mississippi Burning. I don't appreciate about this. A tragic event took place in my hometown. 3 civil rights workers came to Philadelphia. They called it Freedom Summer. And these guys were taken to the edge of town, taken out of the woods, and murdered. And the whole town went upside down. The eyes of the world drew down on Philadelphia, Mississippi. It was a hard, hard, hard time. And where I first heard the Staples singers, there was a song called We Shall Overcome that was kind of an anthem to that movement, the civil rights movement back then. But the Staples singers had a song called Uncloudy Day, which was an old gospel song. And they sounded like ghosts singing in a cotton field to me. And you could hear Uncloudy Day coming out of people's houses. It was played on the radio all the time. It was another anthem that went alongside of We Shall Overcome. And that's how they got into my life first, was by way of just the sound of their voices. And I first met them in the early 90s. There was a project called Country Rhythm and Blues on MCA Records, and they paired country singers with rhythm and blues singers. And the question came, who do you want to sing with that? And there was no hesitation. I said, the Staples singers. And we were assigned the Wait, which was a suicide mission, because they did it with the band on The Last Waltz. But that's where I really got to know those people. And Pop Staples became one of my closest and dearest friends. And Mavis is still like a sister to me.
Wow. They say that you're like the only guitar player who can play Pop Pops.
Well, I don't know about that. I don't know about that, but I love his playing a whole lot.
Wow. That's a great piece of history.
Right it there. Is, man.
You know, Philadelphia's a pretty special place, as you've educated me over the course of our friendship. And, you know, it's pretty interesting. You know, Jimmy Rogers, who we'd say would be the founder of country music. Without Jimmy Rogers, you once said to me, we both wouldn't have jobs.
That's true. When you drive across the state line of Mississippi, it says, "Welcome to Mississippi, the birthplace of America's music." And you can back it up. Elvis Presley's from there. Tammy Wynette, Muddy Waters, Robert Johnson, Charlie Pride, who was just a Jimmy Rogers. I mean, on and on and on. And
Marty
on.
Stewart.
Marty Stewart. Faith Hill, contemporary guys. Hardy, new guy, you know, from my hometown. But there's probably close to 100 writers, singers, musicians, songwriters, actors that come from Mississippi that have made a profound impact on people throughout the world. But Jimmy Rogers is kind of the king of country and the father of country music, as you say. But Philadelphia sits right in the east central part of the state, and it is truly coming back to life. And there will be a cultural center called the Congress of Country Music there, where people can come to study and look upon traditional country music.
Well, you have your collection of artifacts in there. I mean, you're probably one of the most eclectic collectors of country music memorabilia.
They're already
on this
there.
Planet. They're there. They're
in a warehouse there. And there's over 20,000 pieces, and there's strong pieces. And we have a city block we're renovating and building upon. The first phase is the old Ellis Theater. It's a 500-seat beautiful theater that is being put back. Can I tell them about the stage? Oh, come on. The stage is the Troy Vollhoffer stage. You were one of the first people to believe in this project, and you helped us out. And the stage at the Ellis Theater will be named the Vollhoffer stage forevermore.
Oh, man, what an honor.
It's an honor. You honored us. Well, it's the least we can do.
Well, like you said, without Philadelphia, we wouldn't be in business. So, you know, Jimmy Rogers, Philadelphia, the birthplace of it. You know, I mean, you know, I got to get back a little bit to where we all come from and how we make our living.
Well, it's good to know where you come from. It's good to know, keep one hand on the bedrock, then you can fly as high as you want to from there.
Let's talk about the beginning. 12 years old, man. You're playing professionally at 12 years old?
Yeah.
How'd that come down?
Well, I was practicing my autograph in the third grade. Yeah. I wanted out of there. I wanted to play a guitar. During those days you were talking about the civil rights strife, my daddy was a factory worker. And on Saturday afternoons, there was a stream, like a parade, of 30-minute television, syndicated television shows that played in our region. The Porter Wagner Show, the Flat and Scruggs Show. A fellow named Del Reeves had a show called Country Carnival. All that came from Nashville. And I fell in love with country music so hard back in those days. I sat next to my dad. That was our time together. And watch those old country shows. And I knew that I wanted to get to Nashville and play my guitar and wear those kind of clothes and be around those kind of people and be a part of that family. And I got here as fast as I could. You know, I was 13 when I signed on.
Oh, man, that's amazing. So you ended up with Lester Flatts. Was Vassar Clements, was that actually a job, or was just you just played with him a little bit?
I played with Vassar after Lester passed away. I was with Lester. Okay. Lester gave me my job in this town.
Wow.
1972. And I've said it so many times, walking in to the Ryman Auditorium, to the Grand Ole Opry, carrying Lester Flatts' guitar is kind of like walking into the Vatican with the Pope. And it gave me instant credibility and instant acceptance into the family of country music. And after that, you know, I was with Lester until he passed away, and I needed a job. And in between Lester Flatt and the job I had with Johnny Cash was Vassar Clements.
Wow. So, well, that, did you, in Doc Watson, you played a little bit with Doc Watson too, didn't
just
you?
A few shows, yeah.
Right. I mean, that's amazing. I mean, those are like iconic figures, and you're a young guy. I mean, like, you're still a young guy, and you have all this history behind you. I mean, basically, from the beginning of country music, in a lot of ways, of commercial country music,
yeah.
I guess, where, you know, we're genre bending and stuff like that into other areas. So, Johnny Cash, how did you get the gig with Johnny Cash?
Well, when Lester passed away, I needed a gig, and I was just kind of jobbing around, hanging out with buddies, playing shows, until I could find a real gig. And I knew I wanted to be front and center on the stage, but I knew that I really needed some more experience before I jumped out and tried that. So I walked into a guitar store on 2nd Avenue in Nashville called the Old Time Pick and Parlor to get my guitar worked on. This would have been about 1979. And my buddy Danny Farrington was building this fancy black guitar. And I said, who's that for? He said, this is for Johnny Cash. I said, I want to go with you when you deliver it. He said, sure. So I knew he'd forget, but I kept up with the progress of the guitar and stayed with him on it. And he carried me with him, or I met him at Jack Clement's studio when the day came to deliver. And so the door swings open to Cowboy Jack's office, and the first thing I saw was Cowboy Jack Clement was dancing with a martini on his head, and Johnny Cash was singing the Wabash Cannonball.
No.
And I thought, there's two of my dear friends right there, and I don't even know them. But John stood up and shook my hand. He said, where are you from? I said, Mississippi. He just kept shaking my hand. He said, where you been? I said, getting ready. He said, I thought so. And a month later, I was on stage.
Wow.
And with those guys. And I've used that line about from the Eagles song. You can check out anytime you like, but you can never leave. From that day forward, he was my chief. And to the day we walked him to the graveyard, you know, if he needed me, the answer was, yes, sir, I'll be right there.
Right.
So he was my boss. He was my man.
So what were the shows like? So I have a little moment with Johnny Cash, and you're probably in the band at that time. It was about 1974, so that would have put me at about 8 years old. My dad was doing the Ottawa exhibition. He was playing the production there, and I learned how to run a spotlight to the Johnny Cash show.
You did?
I did.
All right.
That's where I learned how to run a carbon arc spotlight, the old ones.
The real ones.
Yeah, the real ones, right? And I was a little, I could barely handle it.
Looked like a train coming at you.
It's great. Crazy, right? And Johnny had just gotten out of jail at that time, I think, and for that little bit of pills that he had brought across the border, I think. And he just came back. I think it was 74, 73. But I think that it kind of always followed him, that badass kind of, you know, thing of the rebel of country music.
Sure.
I learned how to run Spotlight for the first time on that show. And I was so intrigued by the fact that he had this charisma about him. And it's funny because I was, you know, talking to our colleagues here today, and, you know, you and I have been around a bunch. But when you walked, you and I had breakfast one morning at Nashville in Nashville, and you walked into that restaurant, and not one person did not look up from their plate. And it was like the air of, you know, stardom, just kind of the vibe just was unbelievable. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Johnny Cash had that same thing. He didn't have to run around. He didn't have to do anything, man. He came out and he had that presence. And you share that same thing. So obviously you got that showmanship from him, I would think.
When I first went to work with him, the first two records I ever had was a Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs and a Johnny Cash record. And the only two jobs I really ever had was Lester and Johnny Cash. So they were my chiefs way before I came to Nashville.
In those days, you got to play on the record?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow.
And so when I first went to work with John, we were talking, the subject of charisma came up. And we were walking through an airport. And, you know, it was hard for him to walk through an airport because everybody wanted to touch him, get a picture. And he was very kind and very generous with his time. But he said, charisma is something you either got or you don't got. He says, for instance, let me show you. And there was a young soldier asleep, sitting at, you know, a gate waiting to get on an airplane to go home. You could just read it like a book, like he's going home to see his family or his wife or whatever. And Johnny Cash sat down next to this young soldier and kind of went and tapped him. And the soldier woke up, and there was Johnny Cash in his face. And John said, hello, I'm Johnny Cash. And stuck out his hand. He says, I used to be in the Air Force, and I know how precious it is to get to go home. Just didn't want you to forget to get oversleep and miss your plane. And he got up and walked off, and this kid was like sitting there in a puddle. He went, that's what I'm talking about.
So he had a sense of humor too,
yeah,
right?
Oh, he had the greatest sense of humor.
Wow, that's amazing. So how did Connie and you meet? Like, how did that come down? Like, how did you meet each other? And
my wife, Connie?
Yeah.
Well, there was a guy, a really cool guy in Nashville, who produced lots of hit records, named Bob Ferguson, who was second in command at RCA Records under Chet Atkins. Okay. In the 60s and 70s. And he produced all of those Dolly Parton hits that the world still sings. Yep. He produced all of a lot of Willie's early stuff, a lot of Connie's landmark stuff. And he started going to Philadelphia, Mississippi in the 60s to explore the Choctaw culture. The Choctaw Indians have a reservation on the edge of Philadelphia. And he fell in love with this lady named Martha. And so Bob gave up everything he had in Nashville, surrendered his whole Nashville music career, moved to Philadelphia, Mississippi, married Martha, and started helping the Choctaw tribe with communications. But he also helped book the Choctaw Fair. And on Saturday nights, he would still call his Nashville buddies, and everybody loved Bob. He was a great guy. Come on down to Philadelphia and, you know, do a show for us. And we've got the budget. So Connie came to, he was one of her acts, or she was one of Bob's acts. So she came to Philadelphia in the summer of 1970 to sing at the Choctaw Indian Fair. She was my mom's favorite singer. We loved Connie at our house. I loved her records. So Mama took me and my sister Jennifer out to see Connie Smith's show. After the show, I got her autograph, got my picture made with her. And on the way home, I told my mom, I said, I'm going to marry Connie Smith one day. And nobody believed me, but I meant it. And 25 years later, we kind of bumped into each other again at backstage in Nashville at something and had an incredible conversation that nobody bothered us. And it was just a cherished conversation. And the thing she told me, she says, I haven't made a record in like 20 years. I went, what? And she'd already made like 50 records at that point. And she said, would you be interested in producing me? I went, well, let's talk about it. And everybody knows you can sing. Do you write songs? Well, some. So we started writing these love songs. I started hearing her sing it back to me. And I went, whoa, wait a minute. And my heart started going, remember? And I tried to outrun it, couldn't do it. And so I finally surrendered to the point. I went out and talked to my mom. I said, Mom, I got to talk to you. I said, I put this on paper. There's an age difference. There's kids. You know, I've been married before. Connie's been married before. It's just ridiculous on paper. I said, help. And my mother is the wisest of them all. She says, she didn't answer me for a couple of minutes. She said, well, 5 minutes of something that is right is better than 50 years of something that's wrong. I went, got it.
Wow.
And so off I go.
Words of wisdom.
That's Mama. That's Hilda Stewart. And so we got married. So we've been married like 27 years now.
Congratulations, man. That's, and you know, in this racket, it's hard to stay married that long. It's, you know, all the distractions and to make it that long. That's
and when she quit drinking and taking drugs, everything got better in our marriage. I didn't have to go get her out of jail in the morning.
You know, our
wait a minute, that was me.
Our friend Terry Reed told me a great story the other night. He was with Roger Miller.
No, you just said a mouthful. Terry Reed and Roger Miller is that's trouble.
That's trouble added up. And he's like, well, Roger Miller actually came into one of the gigs up in Canada, and he was carrying about probably a couple ounces of weed, which was illegal at the time. And he goes, yeah, I came in with weed in my sock. And Terry's like, holy shit. He goes, ah, that's nothing. I stayed up 7 days with John Cash. And Terry goes, what are you talking about? He goes, 7 days with John Cash. We hung out, we wrote songs, and we just kept rolling. And it was pretty neat. You know, it's unfortunate because the talent level, like Roger Miller was a great songwriter, one of the finest. He left us way too soon, I think, you know. Did you ever know Roger Miller?
I worked in his band. I cut a song called Hillbilly Rock.
Yeah.
That I kind of figured it was going to be, if I had a shot, it was going to be the getting on place. But there was about 6 months in between recording Hillbilly Rock and it actually coming out that I was dead in the water, didn't have anything to do. And we were managed by the same company, me and Roger. And so he heard that I was available and he said, I need a guitar player. I said, I'm going to be a big star. He said, yeah, I know all that. He said, but right now buzzards are circling your career. How about being my guitar player? So I went out and played, like, you know, here and there with Roger and had the time of my life just watching him go, you know.
Was he a hard liver at the end of his career?
No, he was pretty cool, you know.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. My father used to tell me, man, he said, you know, we have a lot of rock bands come through here. And, you know, my father toured for years. And he said, you know, the country guys can really teach the rock.
Let me
guys
just say this, yeah. Mr. Troy Vollhoffer, Esquire among men, and you know this to be a fact. Rock and rollers, when it comes to that end of the spectrum, they can't hang with hillbillies.
They got nothing.
They
on
got
them.
Nothing.
That's exactly and
when
my
you
father said.
And when rockers think they got it, the secret weapon is moonshine. It's over when you get rock and rollers on moonshine. They can't hang.
You're 100% right. Man. It's crazy. You know, and that's funny because you said that, and that's exactly what my father said to me. So, you know, it's a pretty interesting thing. But, you know, I remember back when, you know, bands used to, you know, I remember, you know, Mel Tillis. All the back line underneath the bus, you know, and Mel would bus it everywhere, man. There was no private jets in those days and none of that stuff. And, you know, Conway Twitty and the Twitty Birds. What was the drummer's name?
Pork Chop. How can you go wrong with a drummer named Pork Chop?
And he used to do the intro for Conway. And
yeah.
Conway used to, I was walking up as a kid at Craven, and Pork Chop was, I was right behind Conway, like right behind him. And Pork Chop gets up there and he's like, "Hey, ladies and gentlemen, the greatest entertainer of all time, you know, Conway Twitty." And he goes, "Jesus, that asshole is introducing me again all wrong." I was just laughing my ass off. I mean, like, that's pretty historical stuff. I guess Pork Chop left us recently. I was just having a conversation.
I think
about
he finally
that.
Just blew up.
Yeah, probably.
Imploded.
Right? It's funny how the drummers always had, like, either they were the managers with the gun in their boot or, yeah. You know, it was pretty interesting, different time than it is today, isn't it? So, what's your favorite thing about touring?
I love, well, the road is my office. So I write more songs going down the highway. I had a conversation one time with Pete Seeger, yep. Great folk singer. Yep. And Pete ran with Woody Guthrie back in, you know, mm-hmm. way back. Everybody loves Woody Guthrie. And I asked him one time, I said, "I got to ask you this, and I'm so sorry that I have to ask, but I need to enlighten me a little bit on Woody Guthrie." He said, "Woody was a traveling correspondent, as if he were on a boxcar, looking to the left and to the right, and taking a look at the human condition, and then he wrote songs about it." And that's what the road does for me. It puts me in tune with people
yeah.
of all walks of life. I've been in bands, started my first band when I was 9 years old. Band life is a way of life for me. I love the sound of applause. I love the sound of, look, that spotlight you're talking about it. And just the motion of it all. There was a train that ran behind our house in Mississippi. And I dreamed about getting on that train and riding it to play my guitar. And that bus is kind of the same thing.
Yeah,
it's motion.
Spirit.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. I totally can concur with that. My happiest days are when I'm out on the road on that bus. I mean,
sure.
I love the bus. I love bus life because it reminds me of, you know, we get to see America's backyard.
Absolutely.
And it's different than driving a car or taking a plane. You don't see anything. We see how people live, different states. It's fantastic.
When this COVID thing first started, you know, I remember hearing very early on about the truck drivers, how, you know, and I know you have a lot of trucks that roll, but the truck drivers were the people we once again depended on from getting things from coast to coast, and what a burden it was for them just to get something to eat because restaurants were shut down. People were actually going to the side of the road, handing up brown paper sacks for food for truck drivers, and McDonald's were, you know, whatever. But I knew what those truck drivers were feeling because, you know, when you're putting fuel in your bus, you're kind of eye to eye with the real folks.
Yeah, I call it the truck stop culture, and I miss it. You know, my better half, we always joke about when we're not on the road, it's like, man, we sure miss that truck stop culture, you know, because, you know, you go in and you get, you know, a sandwich or something while your bus is fueling.
That's right.
I love it. And I love the people because those are the people who are making the wheels turn on this country. They're so important to our economy, to just basic economics. And I don't think they get enough respect.
Well, I'm telling you, man, you know, you look at award shows and, you know, things that are carefully staged and presented to the networks that represent country music, and that front row, there's a whole lot of reality of cool young kids that are out there. But the backbone of the whole country music society is what you're talking about. That's where the spine and the bedrock of the country music fan and the heart of the country music fan. That's those folks. We should never forget them. And I'm telling you, those people, they give up a lot to feed their family.
It comes from Mississippi and down in Alabama, creeping like a fever all across the land. From deep in the Delta on the Louisiana shore, the people got to have it, they want to hear some more. It's a hillbilly rock, beat it with a drum,
playing the guitars like shooting from a gun, keeping up the rhythm, steady as a clock, doing a little thing called the hillbilly rock.
Let's talk about your wardrobe. As you and I had this conversation, I was so like, you know, you hit on a point, you know, about a year ago, you and I had breakfast together, and I was like, I resonated on it. And, you know, and it was very apparent, you know, when you go to see an artist, you don't really want to see the Domino's pizza guy, you know, and that kind of has become a trend in all formats of media.
Yeah.
Tell me your theory on it.
Perhaps I was raised at a different point in time, foundational. But I go back to when I was 5 years old watching country music and rock and roll on TV. Elvis was from Mississippi. And Elvis had you could see a shadow on the wall and know who it was. The guy on the $20 bill, Andrew Jackson, that guy had a cool look about him. Porter Wagoner had a cool look. Little Richard had a Johnny Cash. You know, keep going. You know, yeah. Groucho Marx, just yeah. keep going. But they were the kind of people, when you saw them, once they came across your radar, you knew who they were for the rest of your life. And if they did something good when they passed your radar, they were always welcome into your heart. But there was just something about the flair of those people. And before any of that happened, there was this black cafe in my hometown called the Busy Bee Cafe. All the cats, you know, they looked snappy. They wore loud clothes. They had gold teeth, some of them. And I just thought those characters were really cool when I was a kid. And last time I checked, we were in show business. And I realized that some people wearing their ball cap backwards and a t-shirt out, that's as much of a costume as Porter Wagoner's rhinestones were. Let's be real about it, you know. Willie Nelson's look is just as, you know, flamboyant as Elvis Presley's jumpsuit or whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. But it's really, I guess, about finding something you're comfortable in. I just wanted something when I was a little kid that made me look and feel like those guys.
Yeah.
And that's all it amounted to. And I fell in love with the people that made those clothes and those costumes. They became a part of my life early on. And I love the workmanship that went into it, the craft. It's pure art. And
so did you have nudie? Do you have any nudie outfits?
Oh, yeah. The first trip to California, I was 13 or barely 14. And I'd save two. I see those guys around the Grand Ole Opry wear those clothes. Where do you get those? Nudie's Rodeo Tailors in North Hollywood, California. They said, but don't mess with nudie. He's grouchy. There's a guy that works there named Manuel. It's his son-in-law. I went, oh, okay. So Lester Flatt's band didn't dress that way. They were very like Kentucky gentlemen. And I couldn't stand that. I just wanted to look like those guys in those bands, you know, that's twinkled. So I saved $250. On my first trip to California, went in Nudie's Rodeo Tailors, and I said, I want to look at that one. And he put it on me. It was like a size 40. And he said, oh, we can have it. We can take it up. I said, how much? He said, $2,500. And I almost started crying because I'd worked really hard to save $250. And I felt this presence to my right. And he says, Nudie, I got it. And it was Manuel. And Manuel took the suit out of my hand. He says, kid, here's the deal. He says, my name is Manuel. What is your name? I said, Marty. He says, Marty, you're going to come in here one day and buy the whole store, but today you get a free shirt. So he picked out this little cowboy shirt on the rack and took it back there and trimmed it down for me. And that was the beginning of it.
Wow.
But that was my first walk into nudies. And so I just kept up with those folks as time was going on. Manuel's like a brother.
You know, and we talked about Manuel earlier, and it's probably, I did not realize that he was at Nudie's. I didn't know that.
He was the head designer at Nudie's. Wow. Starting in the early 60s until he started his own store. Yeah. He was married to Nudie's daughter, Barbara.
And everybody. I mean, rock guys, country guys. I mean, the whole Grand Ole. I mean, Porter Wagoner. Where did all of it? Do you have his gear, Porter Wagoner?
Some of it, you know, and I think his daughter, Deb, has most of it. But the thing I loved about Nudie's, there we were, you know, it was North Hollywood, California. So you would see, you know, actresses of the moment. You know, you'd see Goldie Hawn in there. And then there would be, you know, like Colonel Tom Parker and Porter Wagoner and Merle Haggard. And then you'd see cowboy stars. You know, it was like the crossroads to so many cultures in that story. It was wonderful.
Well, you know, I love the old history of country music and the history of Hollywood, which leads me to my next question. Ken Burns, country music. You did such an amazing job. And I just want to know how you felt about the whole process. And I mean, you really lead the pack in that whole documentary. And I think that I just want to say thank you, as being in the country music business, that was such an amazing piece of work to promote country music to people who necessarily may not have known about the history of country music and where it came from and how it developed and where we are today and where we were before and how it all came to life. So how did you get involved with that project?
Connie's son, Kerry Watkins. Kerry taught English in Taiwan, and he would come home for Christmas and spend Christmas with us and go back to Taiwan and go back to work. On the way out of the door, on one of his trips after Christmas, and this goes probably back 10 or 11 years now, he said, "I saw Ken Burns on TV last night." And he said, the guy asked him, the interviewer asked him, "What are you working on?" He said, "I'm thinking about a show about country music." I went, "Got it." And I wrote Ken Burns a fan letter the next day because I love his work. I've always loved his work. And about 2 months later, I got a reply. And he sent a fellow named Dayton Duncan, who was a big part of that country music show, to sit down. And we talked, and the next thing I know, there's a knock on my front door, and it's Ken and Dayton, and we are inside the living room. So me and Connie hosted them. We had our bands come out. We cooked cheeseburgers and played country music, and the next day we got started. That show took 8 years to accomplish, and it was a labor of love. And you know this. Let's balance the scales here for a minute. Country Thunder is probably the very best of what's going on at the moment in country music. It's the face value of the commercial end of country music. It entertains a lot of people. But sometimes when you get out into that zone, you know, the roots and the history and the empowering force that it's eternal kind of gets, you know, covered up by, you know, what's going on. So it's important sometimes for a voice to keep it in balance. And I felt like the Ken Burns show educated everybody. Won the old country fan that thought they would never see anything like that. They won. The new country singer, songwriter that will one day wake up in the back of the bus and go, "I really need to know whose shoulders I'm standing on." Should they choose to go down that highway, that's a great university for them. And the scholars and the critics who have wondered whatever happened to country music had something to write about. So everybody won. And I was really proud to be a part of that show because I felt like, again, it kind of put the eternal value of country music, the divinely ordered part of country music, back into business. And I loved it. And what I loved the most about it is our culture of country music. All of a sudden, we're in the same room with jazz and baseball and the Roosevelts and the national parks and the Civil War. Those subjects that Ken, when he turns his attention to something, it becomes curriculum and it becomes a part of everyday life in America and around the globe. So that's what he gave us, a great gift in that show.
Yeah. It's like a Smithsonian
it is.
Moment, right? I'm so proud to be in country music because of that. I think that, and congratulations to you, because it's absolutely amazing.
Well, we all won there. So congratulations. Yeah,
everybody won.
That's right.
No, and Ken Burns did a fabulous job. And I mean, he's done such a great job on everything else. And it's an honor to country music to have him do something like
absolutely.
That. Thank you for being
involved. My pleasure, man.
And I don't think a lot of people from, you know, not including you, but I think we really need to wake up to where we came from. I think that the industry in itself needs to wake up to a little bit of history lesson and understand what put you on that stage and who put you there. Like you said, what shoulders did you grow up on? I think we're missing a little bit of that, but I think we'll get it back.
My wife, Connie, you know, a lot of people still ask the question, "Tell me what country music is." And, you know, I suppose the greatest answer ever given was what Harlan Howard says. Country music is three chords and the truth. Hank Williams says, I can wrap it up in one word. It's sincerity. My wife, Connie, says it's the cry of the heart. And sometimes I think the game gets ahead of the heart and the industry overwhelms the heart and soul of the matter. We're big business now, so that's to be expected. But there is always, as you were saying, a place for that. I love my station in country music, man, because I get to touch from Jimmy Rogers and the Old Crow Medicine Show all the way up to, you know, the tip of Keith Urban's nose and Hardy and beyond. I get to be a part of all of it and in and out of it as I choose. And it's a great place to be because I love it all.
Yeah. And You do it well too. You do it extremely well.
I love it.
You know, it's interesting because, and I won't mention artists' names, but artists have criteria of who will play before them or play on the bill. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of a changing element of booking festivals nowadays. It's kind of like, you know, the artist who headlines that night will dictate who is on their day. And, you know, I had so many requests for you. Like one or two options, and Marty was always one of them. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it was pretty damn cool. I mean, and those artists are definitely trying to stay true to the form of what they're delivering as true traditional artists in their own right, you know, and keeping it straight lined. And you just come out there and kick ass,
man. It's hard for a new artist, or, you know, somebody that's relatively new, to hold on to their heart and soul and what they truly believe in, because there's not a lot of room in the game for those sounds and those looks and those feels anymore. But I don't give a shit. That's what I have going for me. I mean, there was a line in my career. I went, you know what? I got $150 in two banks, and I'm married to the girl I love. I got a Cadillac that's got a tank of gas, and I got the best Telecaster in the world. And anything beyond this is gravy. And you're old enough now, you don't have to be a part of anything you don't believe in. And when we put our band together, the mantra became, if we believe in it, we'll pay to play it. If we don't believe it, you ain't got enough money. So, but I'm a party of one when it comes to thinking like that.
Right.
And you get left out of a lot. It doesn't bother me. But, you know, when you follow what you really believe at any cost, great things happen.
Say it for me.
The superlatives.
It's a Canadian accent. Boy
from Canada.
I just can't get that. Probably one of the best touring bands I've ever listened to. Tell me about them. Tell me how that came to reality.
Kenny Vaughn, I saw him for the first time on TV, played on Austin City Limits with Lucinda Williams. And after about 3 minutes, I forgot to look at Lucinda. And Harry Stinson played on my records back in the 90s when we were focusing on radio.
He's a great singer.
Chris Scruggs is the bass player. He's part of the Scruggs clan. And it's just they're statesmen and they're musical geniuses. They're professors. And now that there's no Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, I'm telling you, as far as real music and real just absolute whip ass, get out on stage and get after it. Give me one light bulb and a microphone and we will have a show kind of band. That's just superlatives.
Oh, man. And the loyalty is amazing. Like,
yeah.
Very few lineup changes in the band. And I mean, holy smokes, that's unheard of too. But you must treat those guys real good. And they love playing with Marty Stewart, obviously.
Well, we love each other. We do. And it'd be interesting. We've never spent this much time apart in 20 years. And so we had to make a call, see who's still around.
Yeah.
You know, and see who survived. But I'm looking forward to getting back at it. We left off by making an incredible record, and actually two records. We have a 20-song cinematic surf record that's instrumental,
really?
That's ready to go, and a Cosmic Cowboy record called Altitude that's really cool.
Oh, wow, that's exciting.
Yeah, you'll like it.
That's great. How did you end up on the Steve Miller Tour? How did that come to fruition?
I did this TV show on the RFD cable network called The Marty Stewart Show. We did six seasons, 156 episodes. I saw the tail end of traditional country music, the way you and I were raised, you know, that old stuff and those artists. And I saw the tail end of it. And I thought, we better do one of those old shows and get them one more time. Or the way the Rolling Stones went after Howlin' Wolf.
Sure.
And or Muddy Waters and treated those guys with that kind of regard. I said, we have to treat these people like royalty and make them sound and look great one more time. And we did that. Mission accomplished. But Steve Miller became a big fan of that show. He watched it and T-Bowed it, and, you know, at that time. And just, he could quote you verse and scripture of that show, who was on it. And he came into a concert we did in Idaho one night. He had a home up there. And he says, I'm going out on tour. I want you to come play with us. I went, actually, we did a show at the Ryman to check it out, and it worked. It didn't look like it would on paper, but the audience, Steve, his audience, they're true music people. They get it. So it worked out.
I never saw the tour, but I can only imagine how special it would have been.
And those songs of his, man, they're like boulders. They're
straight
great.
Straight ahead of rock and roll.
Yeah.
You know, he's a brilliant artist.
I did do a tour 1993 with him. He was a support act to Brian Adams at the time. And he was spectacular. I mean, he had that bus that had a studio on it. I don't know if he was recording stuff every day. I'm not sure what he was doing, but it was pretty neat. And I'd never seen that before. There were two European buses. They weren't Prevos. They weren't Eagles. You know, it was pretty neat stuff. So, but I just wanted to ask you about that because that was a total departure and a great, once again, crossing the lines, which we're doing right now in country music. We're crossing lines. I mean, those lines have been crossed before in the 70s with Dolly and Kenny Rogers and you know, the lines into the pop segment of listeners and genre bending. So
I saw my musical future in 1973 when I was in Lester Flatt's band. There was, you remember those old college buyer showcases when kids that bought acts for their schools would go into a university and stage a series of showcases. Lester Flatt's manager paid like $250 to get him on a show in Cincinnati. And the bill that night was Chicoria, Kool and the Gang, and Lester Flatt. And I thought, they're going to laugh us off the stage. But we went out there, and unknowingly, there was a song called Dueling Banjos in a movie called Deliverance. It was a big hit. And Lester had been playing that song in his set for years. So we did that song inside of a 40-minute set, and the place blew up. And in the course of that 45-minute show, we encored 9 times.
Really?
And the next day, his manager stood out on the floor, and we booked 72 college concerts off of that one 45-minute set.
Really?
So we were rock stars the next day. And the coolest show, right off the bat, we played Michigan State University. The opening act was Graham Parsons, Emmylou Harris, the Eagles, and Lester Flatt. And I saw my entire musical future that night. It's like there were no boundaries. It all held together. It was kind of based around the Bird Sweetheart of the Rodeo record. But that's the way I've tried to live my life ever since.
Oh, man, that's incredible. Did you have the Beverly Hillbillies title song in your set list with Lester Flatt?
Absolutely.
That was Lester Flatt's Earl Scruggs.
Yeah, I mean, Lester had to do it every night. It was like, that was Stairway to Heaven. That was the Stairway to Heaven of that show, you know?
That's stuff you can't make up. I mean, holy smokes, that goes down memory lane. And I mean, Beverly Hillbillies have been playing in, you know, on TV for the last, 60 years?
It never goes away.
Doesn't go away, no. Ever, you know? Buddy Ebsen, that's fantastic. So I think I'm so amazed with your career. And what is really interesting, I just have my last question for you. What's so special about the Philadelphia, Mississippi County Fair?
The Neshoba County Fair?
Yes.
It's a one-of-a-kind event in the United States of America. People build cabins, they call them, and it's like the social event of the season. It's like the Kentucky Derby of that part of the world. Oh, wow. People close their businesses, and they go out to the fairgrounds. This has been going on since 1898, I think. Spend the week. There's horse races. There's political speeches. There's music that comes and goes throughout the week. But it's basically just they call it Mississippi's giant house party. It's like the Woodstock of county fairs.
Wow.
And it has enough red dirt out there to supply you for the rest of your life should you ever go.
Well, I think I'm going to make a trip because it was kind of brought to my attention by Hardy's agent. And he was like, oh, no, he plays this fair every year. And I was like, wow, that's interesting.
Yeah.
You know, he's been on the scene only for a couple of years. But, I mean, I was like, that's really intriguing, you know.
Oh, it's go on YouTube and take a look at Neshoba, Neshoba County Fair. And it's awesome.
Well, Marty, you know, I just want to thank you for coming over today. And we're not on the bus yet, but we're going to be on the bus soon. And I'm sure when this airs, we should be, you know, hopefully back to normal or to whatever we'll call the new normal. And we'll be doing shows and you'll be doing shows. And thank you for being a part of Country Thunder over the course of my tenure of doing it. And, you know, we played my very first festival that I ever promoted. It was you, Tim McGraw, Lone Star. I mean, and you were there, man. And I'll never forget that. And it was a fabulous night. And thank you very much for coming over and being on the show. And this is an honor.
My honor.
This is country music royalty, and I hold you in the highest regard.
No, man.
And we need more Marty Stewarts in our world.
Well, back at you, Mr. Troy Volliver. One last thing. Do you think whenever the next presidential election might happen, don't you think Williams and Ree has a nice ring to it. We need a Native American as commander in chief, and I can you think of one better?
Oh no, I can't think of anyone better than Terry Ree as being the president. It would be fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank
Marty
you, man.
Well, the bus is rolling to a stop. Thank you so much to our guests this week, and don't forget to like, subscribe, and leave a review wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.